We are looking at the topic of expectations of the Messiah amongst the Jews and amongst Jesus himself at the time when Jesus actually came here. Last week we kind of introduced this topic, and so the focus that we really began on with this is looking at what is the expectations at the time when Jesus came. What was the expectations on the part of the Jews, the Jewish people, as they think about the Messiah? What was it that they were really expecting, and more importantly, where did those expectations come from? Why did they have the expectations that they did? Our study all along, as we've been looking at the Old Testament, we go back and we've looked at these different prophecies and all these different the promises and things of that nature, and so certainly the Old Testament provides an awful lot of information about what they should have been expecting. But when we look at what they were actually expecting, we see a disconnect there. Okay, and so in order to really understand better what was going on at the time, then we really need to go back and take a look at a different period of time here. Okay, and we started looking at some of these things last week in what is referred to as the intertestamental period. We're actually going to go back a little bit even further in this morning. But again, the effort is to try to understand why, at the time that Jesus came, was the mission of the Messiah so different than what the Old Testament, for the most part, taught that it should be. Okay, and all of the different religious practices that were taking place at that time, where did they come from? All right. Well, we're going to go back to a time period or a situation that is described as Second Temple Judaism. Okay, it's a description that probably you probably never heard. How many of you ever heard of that before? Second Temple Judaism, not one that I've heard a lot of. Okay. But basically, what that refers to is Judaism from the time between the destruction of the temples and the reconstruction in 516 BC under Zerubbabel. Okay, this is, Israelites, the Jews, were taken into captivity by the Babylonians in 586. The temple was destroyed and all of that. Well, the temple was rebuilt under Zerubbabel, okay, around the time of 516 B.C., but then it was destroyed again when? Yeah, in 70 A.D. So this term, Second Temple Judaism, refers to the time between that reconstruction of the temple under Zerubbabel and the destruction of the temple in 70 A.D., okay? So that's the time frame that we're looking at. And the reason that this is so significant is because during this particular time, there were a lot of changes that came to the political structure of the Jewish people and also affected their culture and also the religion of the Old Testament world was changed. Okay, there were a lot of things that were going on during this time period that altered even the way the Jews practiced their faith. Okay, that we see carried over into the time that Christ was here. How many of you are familiar with the Apocrypha? Anybody know what the Apocrypha is? The Pseudepigrapha? Okay, Steve knows. The Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha are a collection of Jewish writings from this particular period. Okay? Most of, and there are 14 or 15 books, depending on, you know, who you're talking to, of the Apocrypha that are included in the canon or the list of Scripture in the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Bibles. Okay, if you get, and I've got one, everyone wants to see it, a Catholic Bible in my office in there, and it has the Apocrypha in it. These are other writings that have not been included in the canon of Scripture. Y'all understand when you say canon, what that means? It's basically a list, okay? That's, if you look in your front of your Bible, it has all the books of the Bible. That's a canon of Scripture, okay? In the final putting together of what is referred to today mostly as Protestant Bibles, okay, that is other than Orthodox or Catholic Bibles, the Jewish Bible, those things, they were put together, this canon that we have or list of Scriptures, the Apocrypha and the other books were left out because of the uncertainty as to whether those books were actually inspired writings or not. Okay, so there's a lot of question about, you know, should they have been included in there? They were voted down by those who were originally putting together the list of Scriptures, those books that should be included, because their authenticity could not be readily verified as the other books come. But they are found, again, in the Orthodox Bibles and the Roman Catholic Bibles. They're included in that. Now, the Pseudepigrapha is, again, a collection of writings, and that word, the Pseudepigrapha, basically means false inscription or false title. And the reason that they are referred to by that designation is because that refers to the name that is given to the book, not necessarily the content of the book. In other words, it's questionable as to whether or not Ezra actually wrote that material that is designated in, not in this book, but in Esdras 2 and Esdras 3 and so forth, as to whether or not, and the different names that are attached to some of these writings, it's questionable and even doubtful for the most part that the person whose name is attached to that writing is the actual author of that writing, you see. The difference between those books and what we have is that though there are some who would say, no, I'm not really sure that this particular person wrote this book, and there's questions among scholars as to some of them, for the most part, those questions can be answered relatively easily and remove a lot of doubt from those who are really honestly searching and looking and so forth. In other words, people object to all kinds of things, but whether the objections are reasonable or not, the books that we have in the Bible that we use, those are verified by scholars that, yes, the people who are attributed to writing those and that the material is inspired is generally not questioned, as it is with those other books. But I tell you that just to show that that's where this material came from. These are Jewish writings from this particular period. Okay? There's a lot of, and I mentioned this to you last week, that one of the sources of primary source of information that we have from religious material, especially on what was going on with the Jews during this period, it comes from the Jews. Okay, it's extra-biblical information that has been put together that is not included in the Scriptures. So when you turn to that section between Malachi and Matthew, unless you have a study Bible like Nancy doesn't have, you just find a blank page there. Okay, there's no information there. Because that stuff is not included in the Scriptures. Okay? But if you have a Roman Catholic Bible or an Orthodox Bible and you look in there, then you're going to find that material there. Okay? So that's where that kind of stuff comes from. There's a lot of social developments that occurred during this particular time period. Again, we're going back even before the time between the Testaments to the return from exile, okay? So we're going back. We do have some biblical material from that time, okay? But mostly it's from the time period after all of that. But during the dispersion, okay, of the Jews, in the time of captivity, when the Babylonians came and they carried off the Israelites into captivity, basically what happened, and this is biblical stuff, okay, you read this through, you know, through there, basically what happened, the Babylonians carried mostly the royal families and important people amongst the Jews, carried them into captivity, into exile. A lot of the other regular Jews, so to speak, were just scattered everywhere. Some were left there in Jerusalem and lived there and so forth. Others were scattered all over the place. You know, they needed more workers over, you know, in this part of their empire, and so they carried some of them off over here. So that particular event is referred to as the dispersion, okay? So Jews just kind of basically went everywhere around the known world at the time. Well, the result of that is that they were cut off from the Holy Land. And, of course, the temple already having been destroyed, they were cut off from temple worship. Okay, so the focus of their study during this particular time period, and again, this is from the time of this, you know, the exile, the dispersion, they came back, but again, not all of them came back, okay? So we have Jews that are spread all over the place. Those who were no longer able to worship in the temple, and again, during the exile, none of them were, they focused their study primarily on the Torah, or the law, okay, which is mainly the first five books of the Old Testament, okay, is referred to as the Torah, okay. They focus their study and their worship mainly on that particular aspect of the Scriptures, and this is also where what is referred to as synagogue life came into the picture amongst the Jews. See, before that, they didn't worship in synagogues, you know. But when you read the New Testament and you read, in fact, as we saw last week as we were introducing this particular part of our study, when Jesus began his ministry, what was the first thing that he did? He went into the synagogue, and it's as was his custom. You see? He went into the synagogue. Okay? Well, you don't find synagogue worship in the Old Testament. You see? There's nothing prescribed in the Law of Moses in terms of their worship of synagogue worship. You see? Because their worship all focused around the temple. You see? So this whole aspect of synagogue life and worship, and that really became the center and the focus of their life and their worship, was the synagogue. Okay? Basically, the synagogue was the local meeting place. You see? So there were synagogues all over. Wherever there were Jews, there were synagogues for the most part. You see? And that became the focus of their life and their worship. All right? They basically, the Jews kind of, in a sense, compacted, you can say it this way, they kind of compacted all of their traditions, all of their teachings that they had from the Old Testament, okay, all of the experiences that were there and written and so forth, all of the law, they basically compacted all of that into the fact that they had, number one, the law. This was their thinking, so to speak. They had the law, which was how much of the Old Testament? The first five books, okay? They had the law, and they were God's people. Okay? It was those two things that primarily drove their thinking and their behavior. Okay? They had the law, and they were God's people. Okay? Now, we've talked about already you know, how what they did with the law in terms of, you know, we talked about defenses and so forth, and how over time, and it was a gradual thing. This was not a let's sit down and see what we can do to, you know, to make this work. This was a gradual evolution, so to speak, of the traditions over those centuries. And we're talking about centuries of time here, okay? From 516 B.C., you know, all the way down to, you know, 1 B.C., okay, and beyond. So we're talking about all of this time here that these traditions have evolved, okay? But again, the main focus of all of that was for them to protect and defend the law. See? If we can protect and defend the law, you see, and not violate God's law because we are God's people, then we will be saved by God. That was their general path of thinking. Make sense? It did to them. You see, it certainly did to them. So, you know, when you look at it religiously and what their focus was, hopefully you're able to understand how where they got to by the time Jesus came on the scene. How did it begin to get to that particular place? The other aspect. Oh, I'm sorry, Steve.
One thing to as a footnote to that is that seems to be kind of like a human condition.
I'm sorry.
That's a human condition. If
oh yeah.
If you follow the law, everything will be okay.
Right.
Yeah. I just wanted to.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Anything unique to the Jews, you know?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And again, you also have that evolution of the law. You know, I mean, look at it in our own country, how, you know, in the battles that we're in right now just over the Constitution and how valid it is and how relevant it is, you know, this document that was written, you know, 200 years ago and, you know, and it needs to be changed. And so, you know, we're experiencing that same kind of thing right here. So we certainly should be able to understand, you know, how over, you know, 500 years that would happen to them, you see, in that. You also had going on, and we mentioned this kind of briefly, we talked a little bit about it. I want to go into a little bit more detail this morning about, you know, what was happening on the world stage at the same time that was directly affecting the Jewish people, okay? Well, we have, again, just a little bit of history here. The Babylonians are the ones who conquered the Israelites, took them into captivity. It was the Persians who came along and defeated the Babylonians, okay? And it was the Persians who became the world power, all right? And it was under the Persians that the Israelites were allowed to return to the Holy Land and to rebuild the temple, rebuild the wall around Jerusalem and so forth. Well, after the Persians had their run of power, then we had a fellow that came on the scene known as who? Alexander the Great, who was a young whippersnapper that came up and decided that he wanted to take on the world. And he did. Okay? So we have what is referred to as the Hellenistic period. This is the time between 331 and 164 B.C. Okay? Now, Alexander was, you know, he reigned in this time and lived from 334 to 323 was his empire, so to speak, okay? And part of the thing that Alexander, and he's the one that really kind of set in motion this whole concept of Hellenization, which was basically bringing the Greek culture to the world is what Hellenization really was. And so that was where he determined to spread that Greek culture, including the Greek language, to the world. Okay? In other words, his concept was we're going to unite the world, this whole empire, under one culture and one language. Okay? After his death, and I think we mentioned this a little bit last time, after his death, his empire was divided amongst his four generals. Okay? Now, whenever you have squabbles, you know, going on, there's going to be, especially amongst generals, okay, who command armies, what's going to happen? You're going to have war, okay? You're going to also have change of power sometimes, okay? And that's exactly what happened to the Jews who are caught up in the midst of the Grecian world empire, okay? And so basically what was going on is that from the time period of around 320 to 198 B.C., the Jews were controlled by the Egyptian Ptolemaic Empire. Okay? That's who was in control of that part of the world. Okay? And during this time, there was a Greek translation of the Pentateuch, the early part of the Bible, was made in Egypt around 250 B.C. Okay, so now we're having the Bible, the scriptures that are being translated into the world language. Okay, the rest of the Old Testament was translated into Greek by about 130 B.C. Okay, so what's happening here is you have this universal language that is being spread. Again, you got to keep in mind the number of years that this is all taking place in. Okay. So you have Jews that were displaced out of Jerusalem and the Holy Land area in 586 B.C., okay? And then they're spread all over the place. How much do you think the generations that are following over those several hundred years are losing contact with the traditions and the language and so forth of their ancestors, and are taking up with the language and so forth of the people that they live amongst in the areas of the world that they live in? See? So Alexander's efforts were to get everybody speaking the same language, okay, all over his empire. So now you have the advantage, and this is for us to be thinking about, you know, the providence of God, you know, and I go back to what we looked at earlier. And that statement that Paul makes, when the time had what? Fully come. I think this is one of those things that was beneficial to the spread of the gospel, that, you know, why the time had to wait, okay? Because now you have, in a sense, a universal language that even the Jews have access to their own holy scriptures in a language that they now can read. See? Whereas many of them would not have had that readily available in the language that they were living and speaking in. Whereas now that's becoming much more readily available to them. In 198 B.C., the Seleucid or Syrian Empire took control of Palestine. And this is where things really began to take a tumble. Okay? The Jews, under this particular empire, were forbidden to practice their religion and their traditional way of life. Up until this particular time, the rulers under the Ptolemaic Empire were more tolerant of other religions and so on and so forth. So, you know, as long as you didn't cause problems, then do your thing and, you know, and keep quiet over there, but do your thing. Not so under the Seleucids. When they came in, they wanted everybody doing the same thing. See? So it was under the pain of death if the Jews practiced their religion. Okay, they were forbidden. Steve?
Very much like the time of Daniel.
Absolutely.
The Seleucids is like everybody's going to bow the knee to our God.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And if you don't, then you're going to die.
Yep.
Okay? Now, another very important part of this, okay, is that under these practices, the temple, okay, remember the temple was rebuilt under Zerubbabel, right? Okay. But the Seleucid leaders came in and they turned the temple into a pagan shrine. Okay? They were prohibited, the Jews were prohibited from worshiping Jehovah God there, and yet that structure was used by these Gentiles as a pagan shrine. A fellow by the name of, you may have heard this in some of your Bible classes in the past, a fellow by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes desecrated the temple in Jerusalem by sacrificing a pig there. Now, what do you suppose that kind of thing did to the mentality of the Jews? Okay. He also, at that same time, erected there in the temple a statue of Zeus. Okay? You think that might have gotten some of the Jews just a little bit upset? Yeah. So much so that there is as what is referred to as the Maccabean Revolt. Some of you may be familiar with that. Some of you have some of this information. If you've got a Bible other than the one that Nancy has, where it's a blank page there, you have a study Bible, you have some of this information there in this particular section in there. But basically, this was a war that lasted about 24 years that resulted in independence for the Jews until the Roman Empire came. So this was roughly from the time, the war lasted from 166 to 142 B.C., and the Jews were relatively free, okay, relatively free, and I emphasize that word relatively, I'll explain that in just a moment, until the Romans came in and took control in around 63 B.C., okay? Now, the big question is what was happening during this time period where they were experiencing relative freedom. Well, the Maccabeans, and this was a family that kind of led this, okay, Judas Maccabee and his sons, and during this time period, the rulers of the Jews came from this family. Okay, there was a succession of rulers during this time. It's basically roughly you're looking at a time period of around 100 years. They enjoyed freedom from, you know, other nations, but the problem was the leaders that they had from amongst themselves became corrupt, immoral, very dictatorial. So they weren't under the Maccabeans during this this time period weren't a whole lot better off than they were under the other nations that had oppressed them. Okay? And really, it was because of what is referred to as internal strife that was taking place amongst the leaders and the people during this particular time that the Jewish leaders requested from General of the Roman Army Pompey to come in and restore order. And he did. And so, you know, that's the case of one of those, an example of be careful what you ask for, because you just might get it. And that's what they did. They asked for Roman help, and they got Roman help. Okay, and Roman occupation. And so here, they found themselves right back in the same situation that they were in before. Okay.
Didn't the Pharisees arise from the Maccabeans?
The Pharisees, yes. My understanding is that during this time period and so forth, that as we've talked about with this, you know, very strict, you know, follow the law and the rules and, you know, and so forth. When Pompey took over the Holy Lands, okay, When he took control of Jerusalem, he entered into the most holy place in the temple. Okay? And that, to the Jews, was an ultimate insult. So, the relationship between the Jews and the Romans almost immediately started off in the wrong direction. They saw this as a tremendous insult to the Jewish people. They had asked for help, but what they got was insult instead. So the relationship between the Romans and the Jews was not very good at all. Okay, and as that tension just continued to grow and to grow and to grow over time, we see the end result of that is that the Romans went in and destroyed Jerusalem again, the temple, and all in AD 70. Okay. Now the Romans would continue to rule, for another 400 years or so. But we're looking at what they were doing there in Jerusalem at that particular time. All these things that were happening and developing from these different events in history. So, you take that and you look at it and you say, okay, what did that do then to the mindset of the Jews by the time that Jesus comes on the scene? Okay? And especially as it refers to all of the concepts that they had concerning, number one, their freedom and their restoration and their deliverance and so forth, and how that was going to happen through the Messiah. See? So basically, they were looking forward, and we mentioned this part a little bit last week, they were looking forward in desperation, okay, to the restoration of Israel to its former glory. That's what they understood from, you know, all of the things that had been handed down to them over these centuries about what the prophets told about and so forth, and what was going to happen to them as a nation of people. Okay? There were a couple of different thoughts, and I think I mentioned a little bit of this last week as we were finishing up. We kind of ran out of time there, but there were a couple of different thoughts amongst the Jews about this restoration and what was going to take place and so forth that they had in their mindset this idea and concept that they were going to be restored to their former glory. They also had in their mindset this promise that God had made to Abraham, right? Which included what?
All nations.
All nations, okay? So, excuse me a second. So what you have to do is try to reconcile those two things. We're God's people. Remember, their concept was two things. We have the law and we're God's people. Those are the two most important things that they rested on, okay? But then over here you got, but what about Abraham's promise? And how do we reconcile these two things together? See? That we have to think about these Gentiles in being included in this because that was part of God's promise to Abraham. You see, so what do we do with that? Rick?
In his mind, the only way they could teach the world or other nations, since that was the promise, is they would have to be powerful again like they were under Solomon.
Okay.
In order to go out and to surrounding lands and forcibly, I guess, or somehow teach them and carry out that promise. That was the only way out that they felt. They didn't see Jesus coming in the way that he came and
it's possible that some of them did, but it seems that, at least from the things that I've been able to find on this, it's that their thought really was more along the line of that's going to be God's responsibility, okay, to bring the nations in. So their thinking kind of went along this line as part of their restoration, or after their restoration, then there would be this ingathering, what they would refer to as this ingathering of the nations, okay, into one people that were, you know, under God, so to speak. Now, how that ingathering was going to take place and how all of that would be done, there were some different ideas. There were some that felt that the nations would simply be judged and destroyed by God. Okay, in other words, there was that group of the Jews that felt like that yeah, you know, God made this promise to Abraham, but he's not talking about nations. There may be a few folks that are going to, you know, scrape by because, you know, they love God and, you know, and so forth, and we'll have to accept them in. But for the most part, God's just going to judge the nations and He's going to destroy them because they have so oppressed His people. Okay. But then there were others amongst the Jews who felt like that Israel was going to be judged and purged first. In other words, all the unfaithful out of Israel are going to be judged and purged by God, and the remnant, what's left, are the faithful of Israel. And then God's going to do the same thing with the nations, and then they would kind of be blended together. In other words, the nations or the Gentiles would then become converts to Judaism. Okay, so that's, for the most part, that's how the Jews really saw Abraham's promise being fulfilled through them and with the coming of the Messiah and so forth. As I mentioned to you last week, they accepted the concept of Gentiles coming into the Jewish nation. Okay, what they would refer to as proselytes or converts, okay. They didn't have as much of a problem with that as long as they were willing to, you know, be circumcised and keep the law and so on and so forth, you see. But the idea and the concept of a whole new religion in the sense of Christianity, that the Messiah was going to come and start a whole new direction, that was not something they even considered. It was not, as I said last week, on their radar screen. Okay? So when you understand what their thinking was in terms of what they were looking at just in this aspect of this whole restoration thing, you know, that God was going to purge, you know, the unfaithful from Israel and the unfaithful from the nations and bring them all together under one, then you begin to understand why they opposed Jesus so much. Okay? Because not only was He not preaching about, you know, this physical kingdom and running out the Romans and so forth, he wasn't even going there, was He? But He was talking about how they needed to change their whole way of the way they were living in their relationship with God. See? Right? Right.
He was not going to get executed.
Exactly.
And even his apostles couldn't quite grasp it. Because he was talking about something that was to happen over them,
right,
over their head, really.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he was talking about our heavenly kingdom.
Right.
And because it's already, they should have already known
right,
and by fire. And he wanted to make sure that people understood, mm-hmm, this business about him not making a kingdom here.
Right.
But also that he had something much more to look forward to.
Right. Absolutely.
You know,
But you see, when you start looking at these kinds of things and what was going on and what their thinking was, it's much easier to understand why the disciples would stand there when Jesus is getting ready to go back up to heaven and say, Lord, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? You see? Why they just had such a difficult time understanding Jesus' concept of the kingdom. You see? Because all of this is what they knew. This is what their history had been telling them for several hundred years. You see? And now somebody comes on the scene and starts saying something different, and he claims to be the Messiah, and going, does not fit the pattern that we've set up here, so therefore he cannot be. Steve?
Well, a couple of things. Somewhat loosely, if you talk to someone who believes the premillennial, you see the same thing at work.
Right.
It's God's going to establish his kingdom on earth, and he's going to pull everybody in to one central thing. Christ's mission actually was the opposite. You know, we're to scatter and take the good news out. And if you look at that, you can see the, it's a completely topsy-turvy, thing.
And
they were so wrapped up in this idea of God's going to pull it all together in one place.
Mm-hmm.
Where Christ was like, no, the kingdom of heaven's within you. Go out and spread it.
Right. And those the same kinds of things are happening today that were happening to them. It's happening amongst Christians who have all these different beliefs about the second coming and what that's going to be, that people are still looking for the Messiah who's going to come and set up his kingdom and reign for 1,000 years, sit on David's throne. You see, well, wait a minute. They have the same scriptures that we have, don't they? Yeah. But they're not looking at them all the same way. There's a lot of things that are influencing people, just like it was with the Jews back then. So we can look at that and see how that's happening with us today. It should be a little bit easier for us to understand why there was so much confusion about Jesus back in his day. See? Now, we're not saying that to excuse the Jews or people today. We're just saying it to help us to understand why those things happened the way they did. See? So, now, we're over time here. I apologize for that. We're going to finish up here. But we're going to look at, not next week. I'm not going to be here next week. We're going down to see the grandkids next weekend. And so Ted's going to be teaching Bible class next week. When we come back, we're going to look at some Old Testament statements and so forth that really kind of bring all of this kind of thing together and help us to see what the Old Testament was telling them about some of these things. All right? So thank you all very much.